This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 100 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. There's only one way to celebrate the 100th Late Round Podcast episode, and that's with a Lord Reeves manual air horn drop. We did it, fam. We made it to 100 episodes. I want to thank all of you for your support and for going down this solo podcasting journey with me. This podcast is nothing without you. Like, quite literally nothing without you, especially these mailbag episodes. And today's one of those mailbag shows. Unsurprisingly, one of the most frequent questions for today's show that hit my inbox was my take on the Alex Smith trade that went down earlier this week. Or at least the trade that was agreed to. We've got to wait a little bit until it can actually happen. And my take is that I'm kind of blown away. What in the hell is Washington doing? You've got Kirk Cousins, a quarterback who's consistently played well above average over the last 3 years for the organization, who's also more than 4 years younger than Alex Smith. Kirk Cousins, who finished with average efficiency this season according to NumberFire's net expected points metric, despite the fact that he was playing behind a makeshift offensive line and didn't have any reliable weapons, and who, in 2016, ranked 6th in efficiency, and in 2015, ranked 7th. And you fail over and over and over again to get a deal done with Kirk Cousins, to lock up a player who's good at playing the most important position in the game. I'm not here saying Kirk Cousins is this locked-in top-5 passer, but my goodness, you guys, Kirk Cousins' worst year over the last 3 seasons is essentially Alex Smith's average year from an efficiency standpoint. But let's move on from that. Let's forget that Washington had a chance to lock up a strong quarterback for years to come. Forget it. Let's instead just look at what Washington did to get a 33-year-old Alex Smith. They spent a third-round pick in arguably the best slot cornerback in the league who, by the way, is turning 23 years old this month. They gave Kendall Fuller in a third-round pick in order to give a soon-to-be 34-year-old quarterback $71 million in guaranteed money. But it gets worse. This is the biggest problem with this whole deal. That 34-year-old quarterback is coming off of his best season as a pro, producing like we've never seen him produce before. Because Alex Smith in 2017 played like we've never seen him play before. This past season, 50% of Alex Smith's touchdowns came on throws that traveled 15 or more yards down the field. Since he became a Kansas City Chief, prior to this year, his high was 21.74%. Over 40% of Alex Smith's yards came on deep balls this season. Prior to this year as a Kansas City Chief, that previous high was 26%. It's true that Smith threw it down the field more frequently this year, as 18.42% of his throws were deep passes when his previous high as a Chief was a little under 15.5%. But he exceeded his previous highs in every deep ball metric. Actually, he obliterated them. And all the while, he still ranked outside the top 30 in average depth of target because he was still playing fairly conservative football. Guys, this is what we call an outlier season. Alex Smith had great weapons and was able to do some great things with those weapons this year. But he also didn't do it in a very sustainable way. And the Redskins are buying high on that. They're buying Alex Smith for his 2017 season. I'm not even one who thinks that Alex Smith is a garbage quarterback. He's fine. But the series of events that led to Alex Smith receiving over $70 million in guaranteed money from Washington is astounding. They screw up negotiations with Kirk Cousins, they give away not just a strong pick in next year's draft, but a young and promising corner, and for what? What are they getting from Alex Smith? This isn't a team, or at least right now, right this instant, in February, like Jacksonville, where you can throw in a competent quarterback and reach the conference championship. This isn't Minnesota, where there are two outstanding wide receivers to help an inexperienced quarterback. We're talking about Washington, a team that ran its offense through... What did they even run their offense through this season? Jamison Crowder, a slot receiver? Now, Washington sustained a lot of injuries this year, and I think they're more talented than most give them credit for. But a move like this is kind of egregious. There's a difference between a bridge quarterback and a 34-year-old passer who's getting over $70 million in guaranteed money, even if that money is a little overstated because of the league's cap situation. You could say Washington was in a tough situation, but they also put themselves in that tough situation. And then they overspent to get a quarterback who's coming off what's probably an outlier season. And it was mind-blowing. So that's my take. And here's my take on other questions that you guys sent my way this week. This one's from @PrivateParks. What do you prioritize when you're self-evaluating after the season? I want to self-reflect, but I'm having a hard time figuring where to start and how to not get caught up in hindsight. So on my end, I'm looking at an advice level first, but obviously that doesn't apply to most people. I tend to look back and see where I went right and wrong on the player level, which is what the Hits and Misses podcast were all about. So hopefully you've at least heard that process. But from a team standpoint, in terms of your individual teams, I think you should look at what happened in hindsight and think, what in the world was I doing when I took Terrell Pryor in the third round? Because from there, you dig into the why you actually made that choice, and then you can see if it was logical enough. And remember, most drafts are pretty bad. We're not perfect at this. But don't allow yourself to push aside the bad mistakes that you made in fear that you're just pushing them aside because of hindsight analysis. You kind of have to do hindsight analysis first and then dig in. You have to say, this was a good move, this was a bad move, and then analyze the why. And like I just said, this should include your good moves too. If you drafted and held on to Alvin Kamara, ask yourself why you did that. If you had Todd Gurley, why did you draft Todd Gurley? If you made a good trade in the middle of the season, again, ask yourself why. You don't need to go through something like this with all of your leagues to get a gist of where you went right and wrong and how to improve on your process. And remember, when you're looking at drafts, pay attention to your overall draft strategy and how it compared and contrasted to other teams in that league. That can also help. This next one says, how does auction strategy change for dynasty rookie auctions? You've addressed general auction strategy for a typical redraft league in an evergreen episode, but what effect do the following factors have on this advice? Number one, unequal bankrolls due to trades. Number two, a consensus best player available at the top, like with Saquon Barkley. Number three, a smaller player pool in general, where the typical hit rate seems like it would be much higher in the first few tiers compared to late round flyers. And number four, leftover auction dollars that disappear versus leagues where they can roll over to the next auction. Do you go all in to force an owner to overpay for the top player or win him yourself, or do you stick to your value board and try to find deals in the middle rounds, i.e. pay medium prices for guys with a medium chance to hit? So much will depend on other factors like individual owners and league settings, but are there some general tips for approaching this kind of auction? It's a big question, so I don't expect you to tackle it entirely, but I'm very curious how you would approach this. Thanks again for educating and entertaining us all season. Cheers, John from Edmonton, Canada. All right, guys, there's a lot to unpack here. So first off, let's start thinking about what a rookie draft is. Unlike a typical redraft, you're projecting a player's entire career, which means it's a lot more difficult to get general dollar values associated with a player because you don't have some sort of finite projection for that guy. Like in a redraft league, you can calculate dollar values based on overall projections. It's not necessary to do, but you can do it based on projections. I don't think it's a bad exercise as long as you're not married to those projections and those rankings. That's a way to lose in fantasy football. What this means is that there's not going to be a super scientific way of approaching this. So what you should probably try and do is tier your players so that you have some point of comparison. You mentioned Saquon Barkley as a top pick, so he's in a tier all by himself more than likely. And then you move on from there and you're able to set the market value for those tiers as the draft unfolds. That means Barkley's overall value in the draft may be tough to really define. But let's say another dude goes for X dollars and that player is in the same tier as a guy that you're targeting, so you know the guy that you're targeting should also go for X dollars. That's the first step with all of this. Now, if the draft has unequal bankrolls due to trades, that's something you just have to adjust for as the draft is happening. But I would look at each team, see where their needs are, and look at the percentage of the pie that each team has. In a 12-team league, each team would hypothetically have a little over 8% of the money to spend. If a team has, say, 12% of the money, and that team needs a running back, then expect that team to go ham for someone like Saquon Barkley. And from there, you can use some of the auction methods that I talked about on that evergreen show that you mentioned. So thus far, remember to tier your players and remember to look at the league's overall economy to find out who the bullies will be. Look at those bullies' teams, see where their needs are, and understand that they're more than likely going to overpay for top players. Now, the rest is super dependent on a ton of factors. You mentioned that the top half of the draft will have higher hit rates, but I would argue that that depends a lot on when the draft is being held. If you know these player situations, then yes, you'll have a better idea. But if not, then you're piling on a game of darts on top of a game of darts. Meaning, you're trying to predict who the best prospects are, all while not knowing which teams they're on. That's when I'd be hesitant to go with a stars and scrubs approach. But you're not wrong with going with that type of strategy. I don't think it's far different than how you'd approach a regular league, and that you're looking to lock up those difference makers because the difference between a third and a fourth round selection in a rookie draft isn't the most significant thing in the world. It's certainly not as significant as a first to second round one. And remember, you can always relate a snake draft to an auction draft. And this all depends on the class too, of course. If it's a shallow running back class in your eyes, then that'll just make someone like Saquon Barkley more valuable. It's not a shallow class, but I'm just using that as an example. So hopefully my brain vomit here at least helps in some way. That's generally how I would approach it though. This next one says, JJ, due to your pods and overall process, I've become more attuned to the analytical thought process and the application to a lot of life events, even outside of fantasy football. My question is, how can amateurs in the analytical and metrics game, such as myself, understand graphs and certain numbers better to grasp the data in front of us if it isn't something that we do on a daily basis? I'd love to apply it across the board, including fantasy football, with a better grasp of what I'm dealing with. Any suggestions or comments? Thanks, Topher. So multiple people actually asked me about this over the last couple of weeks. I know your question is geared towards just understanding things better, but others have asked sort of how to get started working with football data. And that's freaking awesome. That's exactly why I do this podcast. I think repetition is the best answer here. To someone who's never opened up Excel before in their entire life, learning all of this would be really difficult versus someone who's tech savvy and can build things in an Excel-like program. I'm very much someone who needs to just do things to really understand what's going on. Like, when I get something new, I don't read the instructions. I hate instructions. I just want to build it or have it be built. And I like the trial and error method. So I would actually say that my advice would be pretty similar to someone who wants to actually start manipulating and working with data, because getting your hands dirty is a great way to learn. First and foremost, you should probably set some sort of goal. Saying, I want to understand this better won't get you very far because it's too broad. That's really the case for anything, not just football data and analytics. If you want to look for a specific answer on something, like if you want to look at passing trends through the years, then that's a good first step because it allows you to go searching for something meaningful. Without that meaning, you're not doing anything worthwhile. The same goes for if and when you see a confusing chart or if you read something that doesn't make sense. Your goal is to understand what that chart is saying, so you should dig into and research whatever metric is being used to produce that chart. There are lots of data sites to help you find answers too if you're looking to do some digging yourself. Pro Football Reference is an incredible resource where you can query information. FantasyData.com has downloadable spreadsheets that you can manipulate a bit. NFL.com has our next-gen stats. Obviously, NumberFire has projections in our net expected points model. So I'd find my purpose, I'd look for what I'm attempting to look at or solve, and then go from there and find data resources. Then I'd start manipulating that data to get what you want. Legitimately though, the more you work with data, the better you're going to be with understanding data. If you're not wanting to read stats books and get to know things from that perspective, then that's probably your best course of action. And look, guys, this is going to come a lot more natural to some than others. Just like some people can write better than others. With numbers, it's no different. This next question says, hey, JJ, I've seen you lament your frustrations on Twitter with Jay Feely as an in-game kicking situation analyst on TV and would instead like to see him replaced with an in-game fantasy football analyst. I think that's a pretty fascinating idea, and I'm curious what you envision that role to be and what kind of content you see a fantasy expert providing during broadcasts. I don't know if the world is ready for net expected points just yet, but I do think it's smart to acknowledge that a lot of viewers are watching football for their fantasy players, and a fantasy analyst would be far more interesting than a breakdown on win relative to a 31-yard field goal in a 28-3 game. Justin. We've got multiple sports networks that dedicate hours and hours to fantasy football content all year round. We have no networks dedicating a single show to kicking analysis because no one cares about kicking analysis. I mean, a fantasy football analyst during a broadcast can be someone who's simply talking about how guys are performing fantasy-wise and where that player ranks in that given week. Or putting a narrative around it and how maybe consensus was really high on him but he's not coming through for fantasy owners. Or how a player isn't seeing as much volume as we expected or how a dude is seeing more than we expected, which is leading to fewer or more fantasy points. It can be that basic. To me, it would be less advice-driven because you get advice before games start, but it would be more of a summary where you're letting people know how players are performing versus maybe how we all expected them to perform. This last question is from @Luke44920117. It's a lot of numbers, Luke. Purely from a fantasy football perspective, do you consider the lead back in a backfield as the one who receives the most touches or the most snaps? So Luke, generally the two are correlated really strongly. The top players in snap rate last year were Le'Veon Bell, Todd Gurley, Carlos Hyde, Melvin Gordon, Christian McCaffrey, Lamar Miller, LeSean McCoy, Ezekiel Elliott, Kareem Hunt, and DeMarco Murray. But with running backs, you're not consistently seeing 70-plus percent of snaps being played week in and week out. Like, Christian McCaffrey is number 5 on that list, but he played fewer than 70% of Carolina's snaps in 6 games last year. I think it's a combination of everything, though. You have to be looking at rushing attempt market share in the backfield to see if he's the lead early down back, and then you can look at overall snap share and receiving shares to see if the guy's a true every down back, not just a, quote, lead back. I mean, you need to be on the field to see volume. If a player's seeing volume, but he's not on the field a whole lot, there's the potential for regression. That's why I cite snap rates all the time in my content. The alternative isn't necessarily true either, because some players don't play a type of football where they demand the ball, like a blocking tight end. But some blocking tight ends do see a high snap rate. But if a player is seeing a ridiculous market share on the ground and he's not seeing a ton of snaps, that's a red flag. The two are so closely related though, so I don't think that there's a clear defined answer. It's really dependent on the type of role that that player plays, like Christian McCaffrey for instance. But if I had to choose, I'd probably say volume trumps snaps, but you're rarely going to have a true lead back if the two are not aligned. If you don't have snaps and volume aligned, he's probably not going to be a true lead back. You're going to instead have a running back by committee. That's the last question for this week, though. I want to thank you all again for listening to this 100th episode of the Late Round Podcast. It means so much to me. If you've yet to subscribe to this show, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And if you haven't yet, go to numberfire.com and take a look at my Super Bowl preview. I looked at a lot of numbers-driven angles and broke down the game, and it can serve as a good primer before you watch the game on Sunday. Thanks for listening, though, everyone, and enjoy the big game this weekend.